You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
A man of science who sought to create a man after his own image, without reckoning upon God.
From WNYC in New York, I'm Kurt Anderson. As living beings, we're programmed to do just pretty much one thing, create life.
And a naturalist.
Using sophisticated techniques, they extract the preserved blood from the mosquito and bingo.
It's alive! In the name of God!
But in the movies, as in the real world, it often doesn't work out the way it's planned.
Imbalanced nanomed activity.
Holy contamination!
It's Andromeda!
Level 5 is sealed.
I was supposed to be injected into the body of a laboratory rabbit, and somehow I got inside you instead.
An alteration. Genetic. A deformity.
Ever since scientists started to gain a little control over the mysteries of life, our imaginations have run wild with possibilities. Almost 200 years ago, Mary Shelley imagined the tragic fate of a creature made by Dr. Frankenstein. And in her preface to the book, she made sure to mention that scientific authorities of her time thought the premise was not impossible. Today in Studio 360, we're going to look at how writers and artists are grappling with the news from the biology labs, from genetically manipulated crops to the possibility of human cloning. Joining me to talk about all this is Margaret Atwood. Her novels, like The Handmaid's Tale, have a way of capturing our collective anxieties and spinning them into sharp, provocative stories. In Oryx and Crake, her recent book, she imagines a world where designer drugs and gene splicing have gone horribly out of control. Margaret Atwood, welcome to Studio 360.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, when did you first get compelled to use science as a premise for your fiction?
Well, I grew up amongst the scientists. My father was a scientist. He was a forest entomologist. And I have an older brother who is currently a scientist. He's a neurophysiologist specializing in the synapse. So when I was growing up, it was science. People who came to dinner were most likely to be biologists. And when we were little, my brother and I used to invent imaginary planets with imaginary plants and animals on them, not knowing that someday people would be able to make imaginary plants and animals themselves, really. And then I became a writer when I was 16 and on. And I took to reading pop science for relaxation. By pop science, I mean the part where I did not have to do the math.
Uh-huh.
Somebody else did it and then told me what they found out. And reading of choice on airplanes is still, you know, Scientific American or
right.
Discovery. I like that one. There's a new one called Seed.
Yes.
I don't know whether you've caught up with
Seed. I have. It's a Canadian magazine, is it not?
Yeah, it is. And so that's, you know, I read in that area just to be able to carry on dinner table conversations with my relatives because they're not about to discuss the latest new novel. So I have to be able to discuss the latest new tapeworm.
Did you ever think about becoming a scientist yourself?
That was the path I was on. In fact, I probably would be cloning your potatoes right now, making them glow in the dark, if I had not become a writer, because my science marks were actually better than my English marks. Why? Because I was a bad speller, and they used to take half a mark off for spelling. So my science marks were way up there, but I got overtaken by writing at the age of 16, and it was just what I wanted to do.
Your novel, Oryx and Crake, which came out last year, is a dystopian view of our real world. How did you approach conjuring that future?
Yes, well, I pretty much confine myself to planet Earth, and I don't like to put anything into books like The Handmaid's Tale or Oryx and Crake that I haven't researched and that I don't have the backup for. So I put nothing into Handmaid's Tale that the human race had not already done, so it's all possible. Whether it's plausible is another question, but it's possible. So some people are surprised to hear that the green luminous rabbit already exists, but it does. The spider goat already exists. It's in Montreal happily making silk for bulletproof vests. And just as I published the book, came news that they'd invented a couple of recreational fish that you could put in fish tanks that light up. There's a red one and a blue one now. So we have now the possibility to mix and match all kinds of things. We've just opened the biggest toy box in the world. But Oryx and Crake is not about science is bad, because I don't think science is bad. Science is just a tool. I think it's a book about what happens when nobody's minding the shop.
I'd love it if you could read a passage from Oryx and Crake.
Okay, here we go. All right, here Jimmy, the hero of our story, is touring a biologically structured university with his friend Crake, who is a genius, which Jimmy is not. They were standing in front of a series of cages. Each contained a dog. There were many different breeds and sizes, but all were gazing at Jimmy with eyes of love. All were wagging their tails. "It's a dog pound," said Jimmy. "Not quite," said Crake. "Don't go beyond the guardrail. Don't stick your hand in." "They look friendly enough," said Jimmy. His old longing for a pet came over him. "Are they for sale?" "They aren't dogs. They just look like dogs. They're wolvogs. They're bred to deceive. Reach out to pat them, they'll take your hand off. There's a large pit bull component." "Why make a dog like that?" said Jimmy, taking a step back. "Who'd want one?" "It's a corpse thing," said Crake. "Commission work, a lot of funding. They want to put them in moats or something." "Moats?" "Yeah, better than an alarm system. No way of disarming these guys, and no way of making pals with them, not like real dogs." "What if they get out? Go on the rampage, start breeding. Then the population spirals out of control like those big green rabbits." "That would be a problem," said Crake, "but they won't get out. Nature is to zoos as God is to churches." "Meaning what?" said Jimmy. He wasn't paying close attention. He was worrying about the wolvogs. Why is it he feels some line has been crossed, some boundary transgressed? How much is too much? How far is too far? "Those walls and bars are there for a reason," said Crake. "Not to keep us out, but to keep them in. Mankind needs barriers in both cases." "Them?" "Nature and God." "I thought you didn't believe in God," said Jimmy. "I don't believe in nature either," said Crake. "Or not with a capital N."
Margaret Atwood reading from her most recent novel, Oryx and Crake. Now, you say that your impulse is not that science is bad, but certainly in that book, you portray a world where it has gone badly awry.
Well, this is a problem we're having now, and the problem we're having now is that in the 19th century, people who were scientists were passionately interested in the subject and had independent incomes, because it was not then a profession, you know, to be a scientist.
Right, they were amateurs.
They were amateurs, but they were amateurs with money. So Darwin had money. Fabre, the very wonderful French entomologist, had money, and they were able to pursue their interests wherever those interests might lead. Nowadays, things have become so complex that scientists need funding. So you can't just go where your mind might take you. You've got to make up projects that are going to get funding, or else you're not going to be able to do any science.
So you think this kind of corporatized way we pursue science these days will inevitably lead us to a terrible end?
It can lead us to the suppression of what studies have discovered, and it can also lead us to design studies that are going to produce results that are the results we want, or that the people funding the project want.
So do you think there's any way out of what looks to you like a dead end?
Well, we're a very smart creature. You know, we have lots of ability to foresee the consequences of what we're doing. So we know where we're going, or at least some of us do. Will we have the political will to change course? There are lots of hopeful developments. People are hard at work on new technologies that could change things around. For instance, that could make the air less polluted, that could possibly pull back on ozone layer depletion and global warming. Will we be in time? Will we be fast enough? You know about nature that if you go too far against its rules, it will crush you.
My guest is the novelist Margaret Atwood, and we're talking about how make-believe can shed light on biology and vice versa. Cloning became serious news when a sheep named Dolly was born in Great Britain in 1999. It looked then like cloning of another big mammal might be just around the corner. And some crackpot entrepreneurs called the Raelians even claimed they'd done it, that their first human clone, a girl, was born 2 years ago. But they haven't really tried to prove it. During the brouhaha, the British playwright Carol Churchill started writing about what it might be like to live as a clone. Her play, A Number, opened recently in New York. It has no white coats or labs, just Sam Shepard playing the father, and a single actor playing three of his genetically identical offspring in the near future. WNYC's Judith Kampfner went to see the play with a psychologist and an ethicist to help suss out what Churchill's vision may tell us.
The play begins deceptively like a sitcom. Sam Shepard, who's not acted in New York theater for 30 years, plays a harassed father. Dallas Roberts plays his middle-aged son. There's a sense of awkwardness. The son's just been handed a bit of sobering information. It's a shock to find out that when you were a little boy, your dad took you to a lab and put in an order for a cloned copy.
And this copy they grew of me, that worked out all right?
There were failures, of course, inevitable.
Dead ones?
In the test tubes, the dishes, I was told they didn't all...
The father won't explain exactly how the cloning was done. From a scraping, then test tubes, the scientific techniques are vague. But that's the prerogative of the playwright who's exploring science through art, says Faith McClellan, an editor for the medical journal The Lancet.
This play is not about how one becomes a clone, but what one does with clonehood. Because when we come to the play, the deed has long been done. And the play glosses over things that we know about cloning that are quite difficult, that there are lots of failures, that there might be deformities. This is really about the meaning of this technical act. And the anguish shown in this play is a flag for the kinds of consequences that are involved in this technology.
Carol Churchill writes about the toughest issues in contemporary life, but she's poetic rather than polemical. The play is called A Number. We all feel a number instead of a person at times. You don't have to be a clone to understand that, says Rob Marcassani, who's a psychoanalyst.
Certainly there is the idea of what it might be like to feel like a number. It does recall what it was like to be a child, wanting the father's love, knowing the limits of the father's love, knowing the distance of the father. I mean, really, this is a highly traumatized family. They're doomed.
The father grudgingly reveals the family history. His wife committed suicide when the boy was small. The father tried raising the child, but the boy had behavior problems, so the father gave him away after he had a baby cloned from the toddler.
He refers to his son as being pretty, very pretty, which made me wonder if Churchill, the playwright, was giving us a little clue as to the father's possible desire to bring the mother back, his wife, with this technology that allows him to fulfill this fantasy.
As for the son, it's the opposite of the Narcissus myth, says Marcusani. He hates the idea of seeing a copy of himself. The way they did it was loathsome.
You sent me away and had this other one made from some bit of my body. They clearly didn't take a limb like a starfish and grow, or half of me chopped through like a worm and grow the other. A speck, yes. And they take this painless scrape, this specky little cells of me, and kept that, and you threw the rest of me away.
And then there's another shock. The father announces that he's discovered that multiple copies were made illegally. Two of those clone sons meet off stage. Events become violent. But despite the dark tone, The Lancet's Faith McClellan sees an optimistic note in how Churchill's clone sons are different from one another. Nurture and experience triumph over nature.
Personhood cannot be reduced to genetics. Each one of these people has something quite individualistic and in some cases anguished to say about who he thinks he is and where he came from.
I love cloning because it's a wonderful area to speculate and explore and philosophize.
Bioethicist Art Kaplan of the University of Pennsylvania, who found the play hugely enjoyable because he considers it to be in the realms of science fiction.
The real future is not cloning. It's genetic engineering, it's improvement, it's enhancement, it's how far would you go to have a better baby, not a copy of you who has asthma and a tendency to breast cancer and someone who might be depressed. What about getting rid of all that?
Whether or not cloning is in the future, audiences are pushed to think about larger issues of anonymity. The struggle for attention in a family of rival siblings, or the fear of identity theft, or of being a cog in a corporate machine, or even those deeply existential issues which, if you're lucky, you get to think about in a darkened theatre, like, who am I? And am I in any way original? For Studio 360, I'm Judith Kampfner.
Carol Churchill's play, A Number, is running right now at the New York Theater Workshop. I'm Kurt Anderson, and my guest today is the novelist Margaret Atwood. In a moment, a 19th century illustrator who rewrote the story of evolution.
His worldview embraced biology, embraced politics, embraced human culture, and so forth. They were all part of one grand vision.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is brought to you by Nonesuch Records, now featuring A Ghost Is Born, the new album by Wilco, now on tour across the U.S. A Ghost Is Born is available at tower.com/nonesuch.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and we're talking today with Margaret Atwood about how artists can help us grapple with the reality of today's science. Back in the 1500s, Leonardo da Vinci showed the glories of human anatomy. And then around 1900, a German biologist named Ernst Haeckel used his incredible drawings of microbes and some larger creatures to promote his ideas about evolution. The public absolutely loved Haeckel's work, but as Sarah Lilly reports, the artist in Haeckel came into conflict with the scientist.
I was in a kind of cruddy little bookstore last year when I picked up this book of century-old biological illustrations to pass a few minutes. Within seconds, I found myself hypnotized by a portrait of microbial life forms, the drawing so full of grace and color and unfathomably intricate beauty. There were spikes and tendrils and gothic-looking ornaments that appeared like something out of a very weird dream. Scanning the page, I saw a miracle of dense organization, related versions of the same organism, ancestors, fossils, all arranged in an architecture so tantalizingly close to symmetry, the background blank, as if in a vitrine. This book was cover to cover packed with eye candy, with secrets. What kind of person could make images like these? Riveted, I turned to the title page. Ernst Haeckel. Never heard of him.
Ernst Haeckel was a biologist in the latter half of the 19th century in Germany, and he was perhaps the most famous and popular biologist of his time, even eclipsing Charles Darwin.
James Hankin is the director of the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard.
Haeckel wrote a series of books which became extraordinarily popular. I mean, they were translated into dozens of languages throughout the world. He was also an artist. He drew a lot of illustrations of all different kinds of animals, especially many tiny microscopic ones. And he championed evolution as he saw it.
Haeckel had a theory. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. It proposed that, essentially, an embryo of a vertebrate animal, a monkey, a horse, a pigeon, that embryo on its way to full development will pass through the forms of all of its evolutionary ancestors in order. For example, a human fetus will very early on look like a fish, and at some point late in the game resemble an ape. It's a very tidy and beautiful theory when you think about it, sort of micro and macro at the same time. But it also looked at evolution as actually striving towards something at the top of the chain, the perfected human. And with the force of Ernst Haeckel's personality and persuasive drive behind it, the biogenetic law, as it is known, made its way to the masses.
It was all-encompassing. His worldview embraced biology, embraced politics, embraced human culture, and so forth. They were all part of one grand vision of human existence. Publishing Kunstformen der Natur, Art Forms in Nature, was just another means of distributing his views about what the universe was like, and in particular what life was like.
Art Forms in Nature was a collection of Haeckel's illustrations from the latter part of the 19th century. It was also the original book that sucked me into this rabbit hole.
It basically makes all the parts of your brain fire. It has this quality of revealing a hidden world.
David Brody is an artist whose paintings are infused with a sense of architectural structure. He's written about Haeckel's lasting influence on art and design for Cabinet magazine. I visited him in his studio, and we pored over his own dog-eared copy of Art Forms.
As an artist, looking at depictions of wavy, gooey, wiggly, spiky things, to see someone who has ordered them and made a kind of architecture out of them is inspiring and instructive and makes you feel very humble. But it also feels like, what incredible source material.
Which it was. The mass publication of Haeckel's illustrative plates hit during the apex of the Art Nouveau movement in France and the Jugendstil in Germany. I look at Haeckel's drawing of a jellyfish, and then I think of the graceful, curving designs of the original entrances to the Paris Metro. Designers back then, who were scrambling for organic, semi-erotic shapes to seduce the chic, needed only peer through Haeckel's lens.
Designers were actually looking at these things and making, say, a glass chandelier or a wrought iron entrance gate, directly modeling them on his illustrations. So it had that direct effect. It also had a much more, perhaps, profound indirect effect in that artists since then, you know, starting with the Surrealists for certain and the Bauhaus artists like Kandinsky, were looking at this work and ingesting it and realizing that the world of form was infinite.
But if that creative spirit, the joy of molding something beautifully, was a sort of delirious virus that took hold, it seems to have started with Haeckel himself, which may not always be a great thing if you're a scientist.
He's taken tremendous liberties. I mean, some of his liberties got him into serious trouble on the scientific side.
It turns out Haeckel isn't quite so revered in the laboratory as in art studios and design showrooms. His famous biogenetic law was discredited decades ago. The fact is, it just isn't true. And the drawings Haeckel used to illustrate it, turns out there was a bit of creative license involved. Same goes for many of his other drawings. James Hankin points out plate 68 in Art Forms. At the bottom of a dense jumble of frogs is a round, chubby little number with a giant face just like the man on the moon. It's actually funny.
There's a classic example. I mean, there is not a frog that has a face like that. This is Haeckel really imposing his imagination onto what an animal like that would look like. It was attempting to represent nature as he saw it, which is a bit distorted compared to reality.
Which gets me to thinking about what an artist's job is, to envision and communicate. David Brody.
A lot of artists I know are interested in the intensity that Haeckel represents, the kind of like, just give me time and space to do this work and I will produce wonders. It's very much the kind of sense of fertility that an artist wants to have in his work, that the more you look, the more you would find. The more you invent, the more it would come to life. This is a man who was kind of a Faust character, really.
In a way, Haeckel was biology's Wagner. With his epic vision, he created worlds of beauty, eventually even his own nature-based religion. But he got tainted by that vision, too, and here's where it gets ugly. Haeckel extended his fervent belief in natural selection to races of people as well. He believed that the Aryan race was the human evolutionary ideal. Though he died in 1919, the Nazis would later co-opt his ideas as a kind of intellectual imprimatur for their atrocities. So there's a substantial discomfort in succumbing to Haeckel's art. And yet, as with Wagner, you don't quite want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
You know, we can admire the man who wanted to illustrate the world, and we can even admire his failure to do that. We can admire his discrediting as a scientist and say that what makes this man incredible is that his character, his will to form was so intense that he was willing to destroy his reputation. What we want in artists, really, in great artists, I think, is megalomania. We want castles in the air. And this guy produced hundreds of them.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lilly.
I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the novelist Margaret Atwood about artists and biology. Margaret, you've spoken about the great golden age of non-specialist scientists in the 19th century, and Haeckel sounds like kind of the ultimate version of that. It's almost impossible to imagine today somebody being simultaneously that kind of artist and scientist, isn't it?
Well, he sounds a little bit more like an artist than a scientist.
Yeah.
But thinking about him raises the question at the core of all of this. Now that we can do genetic engineering, who is going to make the pronouncement, all right, here's what we're striving for, this is going to be the perfect human being, and everybody else is going to be called imperfect. And that is one of the real dangers at the heart of all of this. Who's going to decide? Well, usually you find that they decide in their own favor.
Yeah.
That their idea of a perfect human being is really quite a lot like them, except immortal.
And now that we have all these amazing scientific genetic tools that would give an evil eugenicist the ability to really create a master race, the prospect of a Hitler in this context becomes absolutely terrifying.
You know, you don't even have to postulate an evil geneticist. All you have to do is think about parents deciding what they want their babies to be like. What are they going to decide, and who is going to influence those decisions? You know, what is going to be the norm of perfection towards which they all want to strive? That's the scary thing, and it also means that the kind of kinds of things that nature will come up with on its own are going to be ruled out. However, I don't think you need to worry about that right now because there are, 6 billion people in the world and growing, and certainly not all of those people are going to be able to afford genetic engineering should it come to that. And indeed, global warming may overtake us long before that time.
So we'll be destroyed by one biological disaster before we ever have a chance to commit the other.
Well, I don't know about that. I think it would be very hard to kill everybody on the planet. And even in my book, not everybody on the planet is killed.
Practically everybody.
Almost. A plague for which we had no vaccine and no resistance would make a pretty clean sweep. You know that when Europeans hit North America, it was much more populated than we used to think. And when Europeans got to some native communities, they had been 100% wiped out already before even any white people even got there. The diseases had got there first.
I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the novelist Margaret Atwood about artists and biology. Margaret, on your website, you have a collection of headlines and news stories that obviously inspired Oryx and Crake. I wondered if you're always trolling through the scientific literature to find ideas for your fiction.
I think it's more that I read for pleasure and instruction, and every once in a while something will jump out at you. For instance, I read the back pages of newspapers, which is often where the stories that will become the front pages begin. As I said, I didn't put anything into Oryx and Crake that doesn't have its corresponding clipping in the ominous brown clipping box. So I wanted to be able to back things up, but I'm not constantly looking for ideas. It's more like when I'm writing a novel, these ideas present themselves.
The painter Alexis Rockman is also intrigued by news from the scientific world. He wants his work to help people visualize and, frankly, get a little freaked out by big phenomena like genetic engineering and global warming. Trey Kay learned how Rockman tries to get science on his side for his pictures of the future.
Alexis Rockman is a time traveler.
One of the great things that I think painting can do is time travel, and that's one of the few frontiers that are left.
Last spring, he had a show in London called Wonderful World that gave a glimpse into that frontier. In one work called The Farm, Rockman painted an evolutionary spectrum of chickens, cows, and pigs. How they looked in the past, how we know them today, and what they might be like with unimpeded genetic engineering.
The chicken has six wings and no feathers. The pig is ripe with human organs for to be harvested for xenotransplantation, which means taking the organs out of one organism and putting it into another. The cow is enormous and obviously is able to produce a great deal of milk.
Rockman's style has some of the earnest realism of American agricultural painters like Grant Wood or Thomas Hart Benton. But along with the farm animals, there's a lab rat with a human ear grafted onto its back. The mutant rat made me think of Salvador Dali, the way his paintings mess with your head by presenting something familiar besides something grotesquely distorted. Still, Rockman wants his paintings to be scientifically accurate. A molecular biologist named Rob LaSalle helped him envision the future in the farm painting. He has also worked with Professor Peter Ward, a paleontologist and astrobiologist who frequently consults with NASA.
Alexis, again, had a very good scientific background and training. Don't forget, his mother is a front-rank archaeologist and academic and very well thought of in her own field. That has certainly rubbed off on him.
Rockman's mother worked at the Museum of Natural History in New York. Alexis grew up in the city during the 1970s when air pollution was becoming an issue across the country.
Having grown up in Manhattan, I used to gaze across the East River. I actually used to see the Con Ed plant in the 70s billowing out pollution, and I never forgot it and could never reconcile the disconnect between understanding, like, why would someone, you know, logically allow that to happen? And obviously, as a child, you're not in a position to do anything about it.
But through his painting, Rockman is finding that he can do something. Not long ago, he was approached by the director of the Brooklyn Museum of Art to make a work that would imagine the Earth dramatically transformed by global warming. The result is a mural called Manifest Destiny.
It's a 8x24-foot painting that tries to imagine, with as much scientific accuracy as possible, what global climate change might bring to New York and specifically Brooklyn in 3,000 years.
What you see are the remains of buildings framed between the Brooklyn and Manhattan bridges. Almost everything is completely submerged underwater. This is because of the rising tides due to the melting polar ice caps. The painting shows several seawalls that were built in a futile attempt to keep the water out. Rockman asked Peter Ward about how extreme heat and tropical water might erode the granite of the Brooklyn Bridge.
I began thinking from my early geological education, what does granite erode like? And it erodes in a bunch of big spheres. It sloughs off in a very characteristic fashion. And we were talking about what the abutments would look like. And then he said, oh, by the way, the abutments are underwater. Well, now that's a different kettle of fish, different kettle of tropical fish, because now you're dealing with warm water going over these things instead of air.
Rockman's tropical East River has a striking orange or tea color. The vibrant color reminded me of the grand and lush landscapes of the Hudson River School painters like Frederick Church. Although Alexis loves Church's paintings, he says that his tea-colored river came from his conversations with Peter Ward.
Well, anytime one goes to the tropics, you really see that most of the rivers, the slow-moving rivers at least, are very brown-orange tinged. First of all, you have so much rotting vegetation on the banks, and rain washes the rotting leaves and the rotting material into the water. There's a tannic acid that is produced, and you get this sort of very characteristic orange color.
Why not make the river orange? So that's a perfect example of how a scientific idea became visceral and visual.
Manifest Destiny is a gorgeous painting, but many might find it disturbing because there don't seem to be any people in the future, and civilization as we know it is in ruins.
Well, I would say that I'm doing my job if they find it disturbing, because I'm disturbed too. And I think that anyone with a brain in their head at this point in history should be disturbed by human activity. It's a legacy of death and destruction.
I think you're quoted as saying that you have a position of ambivalence with regard to the future you depict. How can you paint this dystopian future without really judging it?
Well, I mean, there's shades of judging, but what I'm fascinated by, I mean, in the paintings that we're looking at right now, on the left, harbor seals that are going about their business, and on the right is a snakehead going about its business. And, you know, it's dystopian for humans, but the snakehead looks like it has a bright future, so it depends on your point of view.
For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kay.
You can see some images of Alexis Rockman's work on our website at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I'm talking today with the novelist Margaret Atwood. Margaret, does it strike you, as it does me, that he's envisioning a world a lot like your Oryx and Crake world?
He's envisioning a world very similar to the Oryx and Crake world, because we are probably both drawing from the same pool of data. Except I wouldn't say 3,000 years. We find that global warming is proceeding much faster than people had thought that it would, and we also know from going down through old ice that climates can flip a lot faster than we used to think they could. So you may not be looking at 3,000 years, you may be looking at 30 to 50 years.
Now, Rockman is using this pool of real data, and like you, he is also the child of a scientist. Do you think it's important for artists to stick to accuracy, scientific accuracy, when they're dealing with these issues, or is poetic license just as important?
It depends what they want to do, really what the aim is. If the aim is to make a real projection of possibility, then they've got to stick to things that we know can happen. If, on the other hand, we're in the realm of fantasy, if we're exploring the human mind through images of, for instance, angels or devils or some variation of the above, or talking animals, et cetera, that's a different kind of fiction.
The novelist Margaret Atwood is my guest today in Studio 360. In a few minutes, I'll check in with a real live genius biologist, Richard Dawkins. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Studio 360 is brought to you by Nonesuch Records, now featuring A Ghost is Born, the new album by Wilco, now on tour across the U.S. A Ghost is Born is available at tower.com/nonesuch.
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and I'm talking today with the novelist Margaret Atwood about how art can help us wrestle with some of the questions biology is posing. 20 years ago, Margaret, your fascinating novel, The Handmaid's Tale, supposed that environmental damage might cause a huge drop in female fertility. Let's hear a little bit of the movie they made from the novel.
On this day of consecration, you would do well to remember by what deadly steps we were brought here. The folly of mankind, and of womankind as well. Sexual promiscuity, widespread abortion, birth control, test tube babies, genetic engineering. Genetic engineering, artificial insemination. God, in his profound compassion, has seen fit to punish us, to send a plague of barrenness, a desert of infertility. You have been given this precious gift.
Precious gift.
You are fertile. You can give birth.
Precious gift.
In your story, men have enslaved fertile women as breeders in order to keep the population up. In one interview, you said that that scenario wasn't far-fetched at all. How come?
Well, The Handmaid's Tale is the dictatorship, and like all dictatorships, it's a pyramid, and top dogs at the top, and the top dogs can both be top men and top women. And then in descending order, we get everybody else until we get to the people on the bottom. And that's how those things are always structured. So the what-if question that The Handmaid's Tale answered or attempted to answer was, if you were going to have a dictatorship in the United States, what form would it take? Well, it would be likely to have some sort of quasi-religious component, because societies build themselves on their previous selves, just like Aztec pyramids. They never tore down the pyramid, they just built on top of it. And at the very bottom of the American pyramid is a 17th century Puritan theocracy. So what you really have to ask yourself is, what will this group of people do should they come to power? That is the question. Now, it probably would not look like women dressed up in red old Dutch cleanser costumes. I admit that was a bit of invention. But nonetheless, I didn't stray off the path of human possibility in that. I just brought it all together in a place where you would be least likely to look for it, namely Harvard College in Massachusetts.
I was reminded of Handmaid's Tale just the other day when I read a story about Romania in the communist regime, which is just horrific. Do you know about the extraordinary reproductive totalitarianism that was taking place there?
Yeah, I actually put it in the book. It's in the notes at the back of Handmaid's Tale. Under Ceausescu, he wanted to force women to have at least 4 babies. And if you didn't, then you... you were in totalitarian trouble.
And they went immediately from having one of the most liberal and permissive abortion laws on earth to having to nearly outlawing it and doubled their birth rate as a result almost in a year.
They doubled their birth rate and ended up with a lot of orphanages because people were being forced to have babies they couldn't support.
With your fiction that deals with science, is one of your intentions really to change the views of readers about science and the way we use it?
Well, let me put it this way. If you have a friend and they've got spinach on their teeth, is it an act of friendship or not to tell them about the spinach on their teeth? I think it is an act of friendship. Or if you see your friend going towards a big hole in the ground and your friend doesn't see that big hole in the ground, is it an act of friendship to point out that there's a big hole in the ground? Yes, it is.
Do you expect to return to science as a place to get ideas for novels?
If there's one thing I've learned, it is that you can never predict as a writer what you're going to do next. You may think you know, but you don't know. because you may start out on a path and find out that it's not leading anywhere. So I can't tell you that. And believe me, my books are not prophecy, because nobody can really predict the future. There are too many variables. But what you can say is stay on the road you're on, and you're going to fall into the hole.
Margaret Atwood, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Margaret Atwood has been my guest. She is the author of Oryx and Crake, The Handmaid's Tale, and most recently a collection of nonfiction called Moving Targets. You can find out more about her at studio360.org.
Though we think ourselves most mighty as the rulers of the earth, our desires are really not our own to be. We might talk about high topics, but our lives are microscopic. Microscopic, the tuning of plasmic sea. So do not say there is no reason for our lives here on this earth. We are here to bring about enormous change. All of humankind's ambitions, hopes and dreams and premonitions, all but lead to one conclusion that's most strange. The mega.
We're not quite done with biology. I wanted to speak to a scientist who is one of my heroes, the Oxford University biologist Richard Dawkins. A few years ago, Dawkins wrote a book called Unweaving the Rainbow: Science, Delusion, and the Appetite for Wonder. I adored it. Dawkins is a brilliant scientist who is in love with the poetry of the natural world. And he is unique, I think, in how well he conveys that poetry to civilians like me. His magnum opus on evolution, The Ancestor's Tale, a title inspired by Chaucer's A Canterbury Tale, is just out. And I asked Dawkins why he decided to tell the story of evolution working from today backward to the beginning of time.
Okay. Well, if you do history forwards, then it rather gives people the idea that if you end up with humans, as one's tempted to do because we are humans, it rather gives people the idea that evolution is aimed at humans. And that's such a tempting vanity that I wanted to get rid of that right from the start. If you do your history backwards, then no matter where you start, whether you start with humans or bedbugs or earthworms, you always converge eventually on the origin of life. So I decided to do history backwards. It was going to be a pilgrimage to the past. Since we're humans, it should be a human pilgrimage. So we start with humans, we walk backwards in time, and we meet up with other pilgrims. The first pilgrims we meet are the chimpanzees, about 5 million years into the past. Then another 1 million years or so, 2 million years into the past, we greet the gorilla pilgrims, then the orangutans, then the monkeys, and so on back to the bacteria at rendezvous 39. There are only 39 of these rendezvous points on our long, epic pilgrimage to the past. And just like with Chaucer, at each rendezvous point, or rather, of course, Chaucer doesn't have rendezvous, but at each rendezvous point, my pilgrims have the option of telling a tale. And it's those tales, things like the duck-billed platypus's tale, the hippopotamus's tale, the howler monkey's tale. It's these tales which form the main bulk of the book. And they can be read in any order, although they do have this order imposed upon them by the pilgrimage to the past.
And you chose Chaucer's Canterbury Tales because you're English, because those pilgrims were looking for a kind of truth as well?
Well, I think that there's a little bit of that. I mean, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales are the best known pilgrimage story, I suppose, perhaps apart from Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. But Chaucer's Canterbury Tales are best known, and they do give this sense of journey, this sense of travelling. And I wanted to give a sense of travelling, an epic journey, travelling over 4 billion years.
Now, in many of your books, you mention things like the rise of what is called creationism, especially in America. The Christian fundamentalism on that front seems to be winning a battle every month against science. Why do you suppose in this day and age, 150 years after Charles Darwin, that is happening?
I think it's very weird. I should say, by the way, that The Ancestor's Tale is not really a book advocating evolution against creationism. It simply assumes that evolution is true. I mean, evolution is a fact. It's a scientific fact. Some of my other books have been aimed at advocating evolution. This one simply assumes it and looks at the story. I mean, it's something like 47% of Americans, according to a Gallup poll, think that the entire universe began less than 10,000 years ago. That means the universe began later than the Middle Stone Age.
In your book, Unweaving the Rainbow, you find and show us to great effect all of the various wonders of an almost mystical kind that are available to us in a scientific view of the world. And I wondered why the title, why Unweaving the Rainbow?
The word unweaving comes from Keats, because Keats was sort of, along with several of the Romantic poets, was somewhat anti that aspect of science which he saw as, well, he called it in another poem, murdering to dissect. In that particular case, he was talking about Newton unweaving the rainbow, explaining why the rainbow has its spectrum of colours, and making it seem less beautiful. Keats accused Newton of destroying the beauty of the rainbow. And the purpose of my book, Unweaving the Rainbow, was to say quite the contrary. When somebody like Newton comes along and explains it, it actually increases the beauty. There is great beauty in understanding. There's great beauty in comprehending the grandeur of the universe, the complexity of life, the magnitude of geological time and astronomical space. These are all beautiful themes, worthy subjects for great poetry.
I wonder if part of the problem in the last century isn't that modern science, especially modern physics, is so arcane, so beyond the ability of most people to understand, that it becomes like some arcane modern poetry, which only other poets understand.
Well, there is a risk of that, and I think that's particularly true of modern physics, where they're really quite a rarefied few who fully understand, indeed if anybody understands it. But evolution, natural selection, the history of evolution, the subject of the ancestor's tale, anybody can understand that. Anybody can marvel at it, can wonder at it. And that's my mission, really, is to try to bring people to that understanding.
Richard Dawkins, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much indeed.
The biologist Richard Dawkins' new book is called The Ancestor's Tale. To close today's show, we will look at the number one image of Christmas in America, Santa Claus. In Design for the Real World, graphic designer Stephen Heller explains how the image of the fat guy in the red and white suit came to be. Brand Santa.
Santa Claus actually derives as a symbol from around 300 AD. It was originally Saint Nicholas. He arrived presumably on a flying chariot, which became a sleigh. He was a bishop, so he wore a mitre. Well, the Santa Claus hat is a derivation of the mitre. He is also connected to other gods and deities in other religions. Thor in Germany, dressed in red, and had a palace in the Northland, and he rode a chariot, and he had a beard. What really codified Santa Claus in Western culture is Clement Clark Moore's 1822 poem. And that became the basis for the image, the logo Santa Claus, that was designed by Thomas Nast. Thomas Nast was known for creating the Democratic donkey and the Republican elephant, so he created this jolly, gnome-like character. Huge white beard, red coat framed and trimmed with black and white. And that became the image that was forever impressed on the American holiday.
Well, young lady, what's your name?
Susan Walker. What's yours?
Mine? Kris Kringle. I'm Santa Claus.
Then in 1931, the Coca-Cola Company adopted it. They took over basically the same image as Thomas Nast's and puffed him up a little bit, gave him rosy cheeks, and created a new Santa as their annual trade character. And from that point on, Santa Claus holding a bottle of Coke with a child here or a happy adult there became the epitome of what the American Santa Claus was. The most significant thing about Thomas Nast's design is that it wasn't Christian. It was a universal happy fella. He didn't look like Jesus Christ. He didn't look like Moses. This was a character that everybody could love, dressed like a cuddly bear. This was the embodiment of sweetness. This was the embodiment of goodness. The image hasn't changed much because it is one of the most comforting images that we can offer. There is a kind of intimacy that you have with this character. Even if you don't believe it, you still like seeing it. You like having it around. I still believe in Santa Claus.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, riding down Santa Claus Lane. Blitzen, blitzen, all here's a reindeer pulling on the rain. Bells are ringing, children singing, all is merry and bright. Hang your stockings and say your prayers.
Stephen Heller is the author of approximately 1 million books on graphic design. This is Kurt Anderson. You've been listening today to Studio 360, and I do hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
David Krasnow,
Lital Mulad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Eric Malinsky,
Kate Saramek,
Alexis Schomburg,
Lauren Shea.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360 is also supported by individual donors to PRI, whose contributions help bring innovation to public radio. Information at PRI.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Once upon a time in Studio 360...
lived a poor miller who had a very beautiful daughter.
Tanya Pinkins spins straw into gold.
The king was vastly delighted to see all this glittering treasure, but still he was not satisfied and said, "All this must be spun tonight."
Fairy tales, old and new, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.